Make a road trip. Radio.
Take a Road Productions.
Welcome to Unknown Paranormal Radio with your host, the paranormal sex symbol Jeffrey Sterl, and his partner, the paranormal badass Martin Bravo.
And Kevin.
Happy St. Patrick's Day from all at Unknown Paranormal and Bravo Paranormal.
Welcome to Unknown Paranormal Radio. I'm your host, Kevin.
I'm your co-host, Martin brought the box to North Texas Bravo.
And I am the paranormal leprechaun. Thank you for honoring me on such a joyous occasion.
That's awesome. You're going to have to keep that up. You have to keep that all night.
But this is my normal way of speaking, so it's okay if I talk like this all the time.
Awesome.
Oh, God.
Anyway.
Of all his accents, that's one of the better ones, I think.
Yeah. Happy St. Patrick's Day, everyone. I've already been pinched many times today at the meeting because I didn't wear green, but it's okay.
How do you do that when green is in our team colors?
I know. I could have just put my unknown hat on and I've been good.
Yep.
Oh, man. See, that's why I'm happy that I got this taken care of when I was 18. I have a tattoo that has green color on it. So for the rest of my life, I don't have to worry about it. Greatness.
There you go.
Oh, just to let y'all know, in the spirit of St. Patty's Day,
mm-hmm.
I do have my final Shiner Bock beer that I'm drinking. So
it's not going to be your last.
No, well, no, not my final. I bought a six-pack like 4 days ago, and this is my last beer of the six-pack. Because, you can't go through St. Patty's Day without at least having one alcoholic drink, you know? It ruins the spirit.
So. Well, so far I've done it, actually.
Sweet. Well,
I'll have to grab a Corona or something out of the fridge.
Right on. Right on.
Next weekend, we'll be venturing over to Wachahatchee, Texas for second annual Texas Para Unity Conference. I'm going to play the ad real quick one more time. If it plays.
Join us at the Texas Paranormal Unity Conference, Saturday, March 23rd from 11 to 6. Waxahachie Convention Center, 2000 Civic Center Lane, Waxahachie, Texas. Admission from $25, booths from $75. Charity auction with A&E Storage Wars' Walt Cade. Gallery reading with psychic medium Dakota Lawrence. Para Encounters Network broadcasting live from the event. Workshops and vendors. Supporting the Breast Cancer Research Foundation. Info and tickets at texasparaunityfest.eventbrite.com.
All right. We will be there.
Barking.
Bravo is going to be there. Awesome.
That is correct. Yep. It'll be fun. It'll be all of us hanging out, doing some paranormal stuff, you know, that kind of thing. But, yeah, it'll be a great time. It's all in for charity for Breast Cancer Awareness, so that's always a good cause.
Heck yeah. It's going to be fun, man. I've actually made a conscious effort to visit more conventions this year because I always miss out on them because my life is insane. But this year, I'm going to try to make a really good effort to go to more. I will be.
Yes.
I will be going to History Haunts and Legends with Jeremy, so you'll see me there as well.
Sweet. Yeah,
yeah,
man, we're gonna be there at that as well. And if you don't come to the East Texas Ghost Con, I'm coming and kidnapping you and Stacy.
Man, I hope so. Because that's fall of next year, right? Or fall
yeah,
of this year?
October 4th, 5th, and 6th.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's plenty of time, man. I always say
yep.
that, and then, like, you know, 3 weeks before, I'm like, I can't go. My life's a wreck. Oh.
So yeah, that's what we got. That's what we got going on. It's pretty much not too. I think it's like 2 weeks in between Pair Unity and History Haunts and Legends. So yeah, we got that going on, and then in May we're going to Arkansas to that vacant 10-story sanatorium. And investigate alongside Larry Flaxman and his team of our past. So that'll be fun. So that's the upcoming events for Unknown Paranormal. So there you go. I have updated you now.
Awesome. I do want to say that I have been waiting on this interview with Thomas Fusco for some time because his theory behind what we'll be talking about tonight is amazing. So I can't wait to hear more in depth because, you know, you can read it and it's not going to sink in as much as if you talk to somebody about it, you know?
Right.
So I can't wait to hear about it.
Yeah. I know, myself personally, I interviewed him last month on Terrify Radio with Jody and, it's a great interview. And you guys have missed out on listening to him and his theory and what he's come up with and whatnot. So this will be really good for you guys to hear as well as our listeners out there. I'm trying to think if there's anything really going on in the world today. Just a bunch of the old, same old things, you know?
SSD.
Oh, SS what?
SSDD.
Same different day.
Yep.
Yeah.
Now, here in North Texas, in a small town called Lucas, which is about maybe 20 minutes from here, they found a grenade in a residence, and they had to go call out the tech team to blow it up.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So I was like, when you read it on the, because I have Collin County like a police scanner on, you know, on Facebook, and I read that and I was like, what? How does somebody in a small town just grab a grenade? You know, I want a grenade.
Yeah, no offense, Mark. That's the last thing you need.
Yeah. A grenade, a bandana, and what is it? Oh, a grenade and a bandana are probably the last things I need in this world. I'd start a revolution.
There you go.
Well, definitely. Well, Jeff, would you you got Thomas's bio there?
I do. Just pull it up here and scroll on up. Ah, there we go. Now, our guest this week is Thomas Fusco. He's an independent researcher who's devoted nearly three decades investigating the relationship between mind, physics, spirituality, parapsychology, scientific anomalies, and paranormal phenomenon with the goal of uncovering the unifying cosmological framework that has eluded mankind for generations. And since the official launch of his book in November 2011, he has been invited to speak as a guest on over 200 national and international radio programs, including Coast to Coast AM. He will be speaking and presenting the upcoming Spirit Shadows and Secrets International Symposium to be held in the fall of 2014 in Edinburgh, Scotland, and was a participant in the invitation-only think tank conference called The Gathering in November of this last year.
Nice.
Very cool. Very cool. I'm looking up. Ah, there's his number there. So let me get that in the queue.
Man, his book called Behind the Cosmic Veil covers so much, man. I could see, like, all the questions that are asked, you know, within his book, and it's just like, it's everything from divine order to UFOs and religion and spirituality. Pretty cool.
Cool. And I'm calling him right now.
Hello.
Hey, how you doing? This is Kevin with
I'm doing just wonderful. How about you guys?
Oh, doing awesome.
All right.
Good deal. Well, my two co-hosts, they missed out on the last time you were on our show. It was just you and I. So it's going to be a good treat for them to talk with you and listen to what you got to say about what you come up with.
No, that sounds great. The more the merrier.
Nice.
Always, man, always.
Now, you come up with this this model. When did you actually come up with the model? How long has it been?
Well, you know, I got little bits and pieces of it along the way. It really was a matter of just standing back. And
huh? I'm just trying to read. I'm just trying to read about Thomas Kuzma. I'm not in the chat room.
I could hear all the crosstalk going.
Oh.
Martin.
Sorry.
Oh,
sorry.
Hi, Martin.
Hey, how's it going?
Oh, pretty good. So
what you
I didn't want to talk over you.
Oh, no. I was trying to actually find your page on cosmicveil.com. But I found it.
Oh, there you go. Okay. Well, anyway, for me, it was a matter of a couple of different concepts. Number one, just stepping back and trying to take a look at all these things for what they are without any kind of preconceptions. I think that oftentimes we bring a lot of different preconceived notions, whether they're accurate or not, you know, we bring those kinds of things to the table with us, and consequently, we humans have a tendency to look at things through those particular filters. And it's a challenge to try to set those things aside and take a look at what's in front of you, pretty much for what it is, what it looks like. And of course, you know, for me, it was a matter of coming to the realization in looking at things this way, in this, you know, kind of a fresh approach, that things like paranormal phenomena have something very fundamental to do with the way that the universe itself is put together. Now, this is something very novel. This is not, you know, an avenue that has, you know, traditionally been traveled down. But I felt it very, very unusual that here we have physical manifestations that literally materialize out of thin air. And mm-hmm. if we take a look at the prevailing concepts as to how the universe came into being, it's very similar. That we have this creation, this materialization, this physicalization, if you would like, of matter, energy, space, and time, basically out of nothingness. And so for me, there was a very strong connection with that. And so my research was very universal. I didn't set out to investigate or explore paranormal phenomena as such. But I took paranormal phenomena as a significant and vital body of information, body of data, body of evidence that needed to be included with all this other stuff in order to come up with a unifying concept of how the whole thing is put together.
Mm-hmm.
All right. You know, it's the last time we talked. I mean, it's very interesting, and there's a lot of points. It made me really think about what we do and how to go about it, and it actually opened up more questions that me and my teammates want to try to uncover for ourselves and test. You know. Because we had that conversation before, you know, some teams out there claim to be scientific when all they're really doing is walking around with some equipment, you know, in a building or what say, and they're not really applying the scientific method and really delving deeper into, you know, some of these things.
Yeah, and for me it's been kind of an interesting journey. As I said, I didn't set out doing a work that was primarily focused on paranormal phenomena. It's just that, the paranormal community seems to have really resonated with and embraced my work, probably the strongest of any, you know, interested parties, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, it's been a while getting accustomed to what a lot of people in the paranormal community actually do what they do for, what their purpose is behind it. You know, for me, it's kind of was almost naive. Well, gee, people that are investigating something, my natural assumption is that they just want to figure out how it works. But, mm-hmm. Oh, boy, how wrong I was and how naive I was because I only think a small fraction of the paranormal community actually investigates paranormal phenomena with the goal of trying to figure out scientifically what exactly is going on.
Right, right. And I also believe, you know, what you were saying earlier with when people go in with a preconceived notion. I mean, if you expect certain results, I'm pretty sure you could manifest them on your own, you know?
Yeah, it's difficult because one of the things that when I was, you know, sorting through this body of evidence that we all call paranormal phenomena to try to make some sort of sense of it, one of the aspects of it that struck me is that most of the basic concepts and even a lot of the terminologies date back to the spiritism movement
mm-hmm.
back late 1800s. And so a lot of it's quite antiquated, and people have fallen into different grooves and patterns based on that, those early concepts. And so when they see evidence unfold, they tend to look at it through that kind of a filter. And there's some things that, you know, go on right in front of their faces, so to speak, that they're not seeing clearly because they're looking at it from that particular perspective.
Right, right.
Yeah, and, you know, in doing all this, we must distinguish, like you said, between the criminology and the forensics in paranormal research. And what's the difference in your mind there on the two?
Well, let's take the conventional idea that what we're dealing with here at the site of hauntings may very well be disembodied intelligences. Let's call them that. I know some people call them ghosts. My impression, I guess, is kind of archaic, that a ghost is actually a visible apparition. That's a ghost of something. But if we're, you know, taking that into consideration, let's say we're talking about a perpetrator, you know, this is where the paranormal community has primarily been focused on, so that everything that is observed is attributed to the perpetrator directly. You know, it's the ghost that did this. It's the spirit that did that. And, you know, that's all and well and good, but I feel that there needs to be a distinction, like police investigative teams do, where they have a criminology unit. The criminologists are the ones that are concerned with the perpetrator, who done it, why they did it, what their motivation was, so on and so forth. But the forensist, is interested in the mechanics, the physics of the crime. And this is an area that has been, you know, almost completely ignored. So I could liken it to another way that if we thought about an automobile, somebody driving an automobile down the road, you know, you could say, yes, you know, the car went this way because the driver steered it that way, or steered it that way, or got in here and started here and drove it this way. That's fine. But that tells us absolutely nothing about the automobile, about the way it's made, about the way it works, about the physics of the automobile. And so that's why I think it's important to make that distinction, so investigators can look at it in a little bit of different light, and you say, you know, what we look for over here is definitely in the criminology end. And these kinds of things, we ought to look at it from a little bit of a different perspective, because that's more of the physics or the forensics of it.
Definitely. Now, when you tried to formulate a model on the physical process, you know, going to talking about that a little bit more, about what the model, formulating this model, can do to explain paranormal phenomena.
Okay. Let's kind of take a look at the general scheme of this, of what I call super geometrics. Oh, excuse me, guys. Got a little bit of a chest cold here tonight. So if I sound a little bit congested, that's what's going on. But, you know, one of the things that I had to do was kind of classify certain things, give them definition, give them meaning. And it occurred to me that there's a principle in physics that talks about information. And, of course, in science, oftentimes when we use words that are used in the general language also, the word that's used in science, the way it's used, is a little bit different. The meaning behind it's a little bit different. So, for example, in school you learned that the conservation laws, matter and energy can neither be created nor destroyed. We've all heard that. But in modern physics, we have an extension to that. And it's called quantum unitarity, and what it says is that the information from which matter and energy is assembled, designed from, configured according to, itself can neither be created nor destroyed. So what I did was kind of what's a little bit different about my work was to identify that particular aspect of physical principle as the fundamental paradigm of the universe. It's not just simply another way of looking at things or another aspect of reality. It actually is the fundamental paradigm of the physical universe. And that made a big difference, because once I identified that, it opened up many, many different doors. The very first thing that it opened up was to enable me to actually give a one-sentence definition of the universe. And I know a lot of people have been striving to achieve that. My particular flavor of it is that the universe is an expression of materialized and materializing information. And so this is not only consistent with, you know, the scientific understanding of what we call information, but it also gives us some insights into other things. If we take a look, for example, at paranormal phenomena, when we actually get information, and what I mean by information is what I call a primary paranormal effect, which is the actual materialization of recognized patterns of information. For example, cold breezes, or a feeling of heaviness, or just the emergence of a nondescript electromagnetic field. None of those are specific coherent patterns of information. They're changes to the local environment that we can measure and record. But when we get things like disembodied voices, EVPs, apparitions, these are actually coherent collections of information that are materializing in a way that forms a distinct orderly pattern that we can observe, we can measure, we can detect, and oftentimes we can even record it. And so in paranormal phenomena, what we get the opportunity to do is to actually see information not only materialize spontaneously into a physical form in local space, but we also get the chance to observe and measure the way that the environment changes prior to the materialization of information. That many of the observations that we measure and see, what I call secondary paranormal effects, are actually the altering of the local environment that sets the stage for the information to come through and materialize within it. And so this is how this model of creation actually is reflected in paranormal phenomena as well.
Because for paranormal, anything to materialize, it's got to materialize in our physical world for our equipment and our bodies to be able to hear the effect from the materialization.
Absolutely. And this helps us a lot of different ways. You know, I mean, the paranormal phenomena is bizarre. It's weird. It just defies the senses. You know, and it defies all conventional thinking. And up until my work was published, we didn't really have a way to start nailing this thing down, sorting it out, trying to make some clarity and sensibility out of the various things that are observed, so we can begin to then, once we can qualify them and even quantify them, we can begin to start reasoning out what certain things are occurring and what isn't. You know, unfortunately, again, one of the conventions with a lot of investigators, and I find this very frustrating, is that since they understand that science does not have an explanation for some of these things, they have a tendency to throw the baby, science, out with the bathwater and just say, well, gee, nothing is understandable by science. Therefore, we don't have to conform our thinking to anything scientific. We can fantasize whatever explanation that we want, and everything's all right because, you know, there's no standard by which to judge it. And in fact, there are a number of investigators that delight in this field because it allows them to be unbridled, where mentally they don't have to confine themselves to any standard. They can imagine it and picture it any way they want. It's exciting. They can make their own little rules up. And you know, and I don't mean to sound sarcastic or condescending, but when we're able to sort some of this out, then it's like you said, the there are certain things that are physical. Whatever we're able to detect and measure and perceive physically has to conform to physical laws. Just because a part of it might not be explained by science as of yet, it doesn't mean that sound is not being conveyed through an acoustic compression wave.
Mm-hmm.
Or that we're able to see something because it is emitting or reflecting photons, you know, electromagnetic radiation in the light spectrum that enters our eyes, so our eyes are built to receive that kind of information and translate it into something that's light. You know, investigators have a tendency to just throw that out the window and not pay attention to it and lose the science that we can assign to some of these things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Now, this same theory that you've been working on, it to me it sounds like it could apply to not just one field, not even paranormal specifically, just all around, you know, like the inner workings of the universe, which is pretty cool.
Well, it truly is a conceptual theory of everything. For example, it creates the strongest link that I think has ever been from paranormal phenomena to quantum physics and quantum mechanics. Because by giving it a unifying definition, that is that what makes an event paranormal is that it mm-hmm. works by way of non-local causality or non-locality, which means that we have a local physical effect that is observable and measurable, but with no local physical cause at the same location connected to the effect. You know, everything
right.
in the physical universe, in the normal universe, is a chain of cause and effect. Well, what we have in paranormal is an effect without a visible or measurable cause. And so once we give that the very scientific definition of non-locality, we find that there's a number of things that are observed in quantum mechanics on a quantum level that also behave in the same way. We see physical effects with no direct physical cause. Now, what this leads me to argue, and this is very interesting and very useful for us in terms of trying to elevate this field to a legitimate branch of science, which is what I ultimately believe it will, is that rather than saying that paranormal phenomena operates quantum mechanically, what my theory does is turns it on its head and says that quantum physics is paranormal. And that's a very different way of looking at things, because it's
tying
all kinds of things in the universe together. Another aspect of this is based on our current knowledge and the information that we have right now, not necessarily the theories, but the actual raw data, the findings. Gravity itself exhibits the same kind of behavior as paranormal phenomena does. So gravity is also paranormal. Now, once we start playing with gravity, we're playing with the fundamental building blocks of the universe. The understanding of what gravity truly is will lead us ultimately to the final theory of everything. And so when we tie this all together, this is very interesting, because where quantum physics, we see non-locality on a micro level, you know, an atomic level. When we look at things like gravity and paranormal phenomena, we're seeing non-locality occur on the macro level, on the relativistic scale, rather than on the quantum scale. And this starts tying things together in ways that people had not imagined before.
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing.
All right. You know, we'll actually go into more detail with your model, because I find this real fascinating when, like, for instance, EVPs, electromagnetic voice phenomenon. and how you can apply that to your model.
Well, my theory predicted that, and again, this is one of these words, and I usually have to clarify it, guys, for the audience, that when we talk about predictions from a physics point of view or a science point of view, we're not talking about, you know, Swami Mahali predicting that you're going to stub your toe at 12 p.m. tomorrow, you know, or that it's not like that at all, you know, or this is the last pope that we have, you know, based on the predictions of, you know, St. Malachi, or, you know, not that at all. What it says is that if the universe is put together a certain way, if we've got a certain physical anomaly that our current models can't explain, we come up with theories to explain these things. And what the theories should do, and by the way, this is what distinguishes a theory from a scientific theory. The difference with between just a theory, which is what you guys normally hear, and, you know, there's a lot of well-known authors in this field, names whom I will not mention, who deal with lots of theories, but none of them have a scientific theory. Scientific theory makes a prediction, and it says if this model is correct, we should be able to observe this particular type of event or this particular type of data or a function that was not anticipated or predicted by our current models. And this new prediction, we can build an experiment to test this. And we build the experiment and test for it, and we find the predicted result. That's incredible. That is what scientists live and die for. When they can come up with a theory that makes an accurate predictive statement that can be experimentally verified. I mean, you know, when Peter Higgs, you know, 40, 50 years ago, predicted the existence of this boson, and when they announced the discovery of a boson at that mass, you know, Higgs was there, he openly wept publicly at the meeting. This is what scientists live and die for, theorists. And so this is what my theory does. It makes scientific predictions. One of the predictions is that EVPs are an electromagnetic phenomenon. They are not an acoustical phenomenon. They are actually the result of materializing information in an area of expanding space-time. And that expanding space-time generates an electromagnetic field in its interaction with the surrounding material content. That's what Einstein called it. He called it physical content. In a house, we have air, and that air is physical. And this is what Einstein would call physical content. So the interaction of this expanding edge of space-time, which crushes and compresses the space around it, when that crushed space is occupied by physical content, it generates an electromagnetic field because it excites the electrons in the atoms of the physical content and causes them to jump up into higher orbits around the nucleuses. And that can be measured as an electromagnetic field. So what I'm describing there is the secondary effect. The primary effect would be a segment of information, a packet of information, if you will, that comprises a vocalization. Because when we speak, really what it is, it's a coherent collection of information that is made physical by the activation of our vocal cords. And then we emit this very organized information, so much so that everybody who understands the pattern of information will understand instantly what we're talking about when our language is spoken. Our brains interpret the patterns in a meaningful way. It's information. So if we have this kind of information materializing within such a bubble of space-time, that bubble, the surface of it, is going to begin to configure itself according to the materialized information that's coming into it. Just like every object that's fully materialized in the universe has a bubble of space-time that surrounds it, which is conformed to the exact geometric pattern of the shape of the object itself.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a cube, a dice, sitting on the table, there's a pocket of space-time that surrounds it that's in the exact geometric shape of the actual die itself, the cube. So when we see this information as vocalized or acoustic information beginning to materialize within a bubble of space-time, that bubble of space-time is going to conform itself. It's going to begin to take the shape of whatever is being materialized. When we're talking about vocalized information, compression wave, so to speak, it's going
mm-hmm.
to start vibrating like it was the diaphragm of a speaker.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's jacketed with an electromagnetic field, it will cause that electromagnetic field to oscillate at the same frequency and amplitude as the materialized vocalization. So here we have now an electromagnetic compression wave being projected forth from the emergence point that is configured to this vocalized information. It reaches a recording microphone, a dynamic microphone. It bypasses the acoustical diaphragm altogether because it's not an acoustical wave, it's electromagnetic. So the diaphragm, the acoustic diaphragm, doesn't pick it up. The same way that the human eardrum doesn't pick it up because it's only electromagnetic. But in the microphone, we have a copper coil that's connected to the acoustic diaphragm that's designed to vibrate back and forth when the diaphragm is activated. And that coil moving back and forth moves across the magnet that runs through the center of it and creates an electromagnetic compression wave. It actually converts the acoustic wave that activates the diaphragm into an electromagnetic compression wave, goes into our recording device, and is converted into sound that we can play back in here. In an EVP, the coil doesn't move. The diaphragm doesn't move. The electromagnetic compression wave already exists. It's being
mm-hmm.
projected from the very surface of space-time. That's why it looks like it's coming out of thin air, because in a sense it really is. And it induces itself on those coils, and then that pattern, that compression wave, goes into the equipment, it gets converted to sound, we play it back, and we hear an audible voice, a collection of information that results in an audible voice without anybody having heard it acoustically.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my theory of what an EVP is. Now, the wondrous thing about it, and I only found this out maybe a little over a year ago, I happened to get on an interview with a guest host named David Roundtree.
Mm-hmm.
When he heard this, his jaw kind of dropped because he had done extensive experiments on this. And in 2005, they had finally actually, in a scientifically meaningful and relevant way, had confirmed that EVPs are indeed an electromagnetic phenomenon. So here we have a theory that predicts the result that the technician who set up the experiment found, and it was not anticipated. It wasn't obvious from just looking at from observing the data itself. He did an experiment where he put a microphone in a vacuum bell. And this is one of my predictions. A microphone in a vacuum will still be able to pick up EVPs, and it did. And my prediction also says that we would be able to surgically remove the acoustic diaphragm from a microphone, and so it'll ruin it. It'll never pick up an acoustic sound again, but it'll record EVPs fine. And that experiment was done as well. So you can imagine his and my surprise. We were both bouncing our jaws off the table when we were talking to each other.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And what I find interesting, you know, I've heard from people out, you know, in the paranormal field that some of them have laid out that this is, you know, several years ago, but they laid out they'd have a cassette tape, recording tape for, you know, an old cassette player. And it wasn't actually in the recorder or, you know, being recorded on, but then they would pick up the tape and listen to see if there was anything on that tape or whatnot, and there would be an EVP on it.
Right, because, again, if we take a look at a tape recorder, essentially what it does is it takes an input. Let's say we're talking about an acoustic tape recorder that have a microphone, and it picks up acoustic sound. The recorder converts it into an electromagnetic compression wave and then emits that wave through the magnetic head that's in contact with the tape, and it records a voice.
Mm-hmm.
So the magnetic tape could record a voice on it directly. However, now this is another thing, guys, that, you know, I was quite naive about when I first got into this field. You know, I've only been on the scene about 15-16 months. I began to, you know, publicize my work and get radio interviews in November 2011. So I haven't been around all that long. But what I've been finding, and it's very disheartening, is the amount of BS, the amount of falsified, fictitious, outright lies in this field about the kind of evidence that people have gotten or produced. I've already heard a number of pieces of evidence that, you know, other people, oh, that's great, that's wonderful, oh, that's so cool. And based on the way that the instruments or the devices are designed, I know darn right well it's fake, because the instruments that they're attributing them to cannot possibly produce the kind of evidence that they're claiming.
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, one of the problems I run into, and especially here as of late, is that you know, without being the developer of such instruments, right, you run into things like ovilus and stuff like that. And it's like, now that device is designed to produce a result, you know, whether you know which result's being, you know, produced at that time or not, it's like, how do we know it's not programmed to produce results randomly? And then you end up tying, you know, your results to the investigation, and you're like, oh, this is, you know, it has to be this way because that's the result I got.
Yeah. Well, here again, when we look at these kinds of devices like the ovilus and some of these, I call them squawk boxes. That's not what they're called. They're like spirit boxes, or, you know, where they span, you know, they kind of scan through the AM or FM band, the radio band. You have to first ask yourself, you have to familiarize yourself with exactly how these devices operate. What do they do? And then you have to further ask yourself, you know, how can this device then get the kind of results that, you know, are alleged that it's getting? Because there has to be some sort of a physics to it. Like, for example, what I was just talking about with EVPs, when you understand the concept, and you know, the way I explained it, most people understand it pretty clearly. And if you were going to go out and do some specific experiments with this on location, you would find that this prediction is true, that you'd be able to record EVPs in this kind of manner. And, you know, you would confirm that science. But if we're talking about, like, one of these scan boxes that scan through the AM-FM bands, I would ask people that use them, and I've asked it in interviews, and I've gotten... I've not won any popularity contests for it, guys. You know, because, you know, and I guess let me take a moment to talk once again about motivation. I'm just talking right now about a scientific motivation. I want to know how this is put together. I want to know how the automobile works. Because you know what, guys? According to the way I look at it, if we can figure out how the automobile runs, we could build one.
Oh,
we
yeah.
We could logically reproduce a device that on command would be able to reproduce paranormal effects that we see happening in nature. Boy, think about that.
Mm.
The materialization of things out of thin air. You know, the generation of electromagnetism out of basically thin air. Limitless energy, free energy. You know, you're talking about all kinds of things. You know, maybe I'm getting off the track a little bit, but by and large, when I hear over the last year and a half people playing this evidence, a lot of times I hear the evidence being played that was recorded during a tour, you know, and it's being recorded by the hosts or the sponsors of the tour. Now, first of all, you got people in there that are paying to see that,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then they got to give some sort of result. Otherwise, they're not going to get, in future tours, they're not going to get more and more people coming. And when
right.
you hear the box say something like, you know, do you know my name? Mary. You know, and everybody laughs. Ooh, oh, oh, and they go nuts. They go crazy. That's strictly entertainment. That's what they're there for, to be thrilled, excited, and entertained.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I hear how much they laugh and giggle and think it's funny, even the investigators. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, you're the same investigators that say that these ghosts are disembodied people that have gone through some trauma and that they're locked on this physical plane and they're living in this awful limbo because they haven't traveled through the light and moved to the next plane. And you're laughing about it? This whole thing is a joke? It's
right.
a form of entertainment? What the hell are you doing? Are you walking through a zoo and taking a stick and poking the lions and tigers, and when they react, you laugh?
Right.
What human being are you? And if you're that kind of a human being, how prone are you to being a person of integrity that, oh, mm-hmm. I would never falsify evidence?
Mm-hmm.
You
right.
see where I'm from? And believe me, guys, when I talk like this, I don't win any popularity contests.
Well, I mean, it's remaining true to yourself, and that's the most important thing, you know?
Mm-hmm. And moreover, guys, it's remaining true to truth.
Yeah.
You
oh,
know,
yeah.
If you really believe that these spirits are troubled souls like this, because most of the time people say, you know, they were victims of some terrible crime, or they suffered a horrible death, or it might even be the perpetrator, the mass murderer, that's still there. Why is that funny?
Yeah.
Why is there anything amusing
yeah.
about that at all? You know, and if you have that little respect for what you're actually practicing as a vocation, so to speak, you know, why would I believe that you have respect for integrity of evidence?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Now, another thing that I find is, you know, you have investigators that go out and they, you know, capture all the supposed data and they capture all the supposed evidence of the afterlife. But one of the things I'm running into is, like, what do you do with that type of evidence? You know, like, I find that a lot of teams just let it sit on a shelf. They don't try to rectify one way or another. Was this paranormal? You know, and what? How do I conclude that this is a paranormal event?
Right. Well, for many investigators, the way I have come to understand, it really doesn't matter, because it was the thrill, it was
right.
the excitement. It was the experience. I also learned, and a couple experienced investigators sat me down and said, you know, Tom, you're pretty naive. Let me educate you about some things, which I was. See, because I'm not a paranormal investigator. And some people are surprised to find that out. Never been in a haunted house. Never wandered around with a, you know, an EMF meter. Never saw an apparition. Never heard a disembodied voice. Have never recorded an EVP. So I don't know what goes on. And so part of what happens is what they explained to me is this is very competitive, where you've got teams competing to get the best EVP or the most EVPs or this kind of thing. And so to me, the closest thing that it resembles is the professional bass fishing tournament.
Right.
You know, and this is what they do. They trophy hunt. And they go from lake to lake to lake to see how many they can catch and how big they are. And then they all walk on stage and they stick their chest out and say, look how big the fish is I caught. You know, and then they throw them back and it's off to the next lake. You know, so it's very much like that. Now, those people, they may feign an interest in the science because it's the political correct thing to say and do.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, if they rejected that, then they couldn't argue that they were being scientific by using these instruments. So they have to be consistent. But in reality, the science has nothing to do with it. Learning the reality of what's going on in paranormal has absolutely nothing to do with it. It's all the experience. It's all the thrill. It's all the excitement. You know, that's why these people can go in and poke sticks at these poor tortured souls that are locked into the physical plane and laugh and have a ball, think it's very amusing.
Yeah. In fact, my team is doing a class at next week's conference, and the title of our class is Thinking Outside the Box in Paranormal. And we're actually going to talk about a lot of this stuff that we're discussing tonight. When I interviewed you before, we were getting ready to go to a location and do some experiments. So, you know, since then we have done that. And it was kind of funny the day of the investigation. I came in, I had my experiments typed up, you know, just like, you know, high school science class. You apply the scientific method. You have your control, your variable, everything. And I was passing it out to the team, and they're like, hey, I remember this. This was in science in high school. And I was like, yep. And I said, that's how we're going to start doing our experiments. We want to be as scientific as we can with what we're trying to test, and so that there is more valid or validity when we get results. And it's one of those things when we get a, you know, do an experiment, I could pass it on to Martin over there in Dallas or any of my other friends in the field and say, hey, y'all conduct the same experiment. You know, here's how you do it, you know, step by step. And you try to see if you get the same results or, you know, because that's how you start figuring things out, is multiple experiments, you know, done the same way and see what the results are.
Yes, mm-hmm. that is conducting science. And
yeah.
The better that you can establish that and keep, you know, good records and learn how to record things that, and this is the phrase that David Rowntree uses, that will pass the muster of scientific scrutiny. Then you are conducting science. Now you are a legitimate branch of mainstream science.
Yeah.
And the more that this is done, the more that that will be accepted, the more that there'll be a body of evidence that will be collected and recorded and documented in such a way and is repeatable that we can approach mainstream science and say, look at what we have. David Rowntree and myself have been talking on and off. We spoke a little again last night that we feel that we're the first two researchers together that have a good shot of actually submitting the first scientific paper to the mainstream scientific community on paranormal phenomena.
That's awesome.
It's incredible. This is, you know, when there's a lot of people that don't know about it yet, but when he and I met on that radio show, the field of paranormal research just entered a new era that never existed before. But again, when we really look at it honestly and look at it objectively, and you folks, you guys are in this field. You know, I'm really almost like an outsider looking in. I'm an intellectual part of your community. But when you look out at what's going on in this community, I would have to say, wouldn't you agree that there's very few, relatively, people who are really, really interested in the scientific aspects of this?
Yeah.
Definitely.
I would say on a scale of...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I would say like on a scale of 1 to 100, right, 0.5% are interested in the real scientific aspects of what's going on.
Yeah, the to me, what I've discovered is that the majority of that segment of the community, we're just talking about one segment of many segments in the community, the majority of that one segment in the community that claims scientific interest are actually more interested in getting better scientific equipment so that they can better, they can catch more and better trophies.
Right, right.
That's their interest in the science. You know, like, you know, we want to move to fluorocarbon fishing line because it's so much more efficient than monofilament. You know, or we want to use this kind of a hook now because it's a better metal than what they made out of it in the past. That's all very scientific, but in the end, it's all about catching fish.
Mm-hmm.
Right, right.
And
oh yeah,
somebody like myself that has this kind of theory, that packs this kind of power, and this kind of conviction to it, coupled with a man who has been in the field, in this field for 30 some odd years, and the integrity of his work is indisputable, David Roundtree. When you get those two voices together, myself as sort of an outsider, I'm almost kind of the first guy that's in a position to talk about it this way and not get burned by it. Because I don't have to see these other investigators. I never go to Paracons. I've never been invited to a Paracon. I've been invited to several symposiums, but I've never been invited to a Paracon. They don't really want me there. So I don't have to worry about saying something that pisses Dave Schrader off in Darkness Radio because I have to see him on the next Paracon, you know.
Right.
Or this guy that I saw do something goofy on Ghost Hunters, and I say, that guy's a fraud. I don't have to live with him. So, you know, and what he says doesn't matter to me because in the end, he's just doing the same thing that everybody else is doing. And so what he's doing is nothing special than what anybody else is doing, except he's on TV.
Right.
So doesn't have to say, well, I do it this way and that way, and that's what makes me unique and stand out. No, what makes you unique and stand out is you're on TV. I'm in a position where I can say I'm unique and I stand out because I'm saying something that you can't. And I'm demonstrating something that you can't. So that my position in the field doesn't depend on the cooperation and submission of others. My position stands on its own. And I'm not saying this to, I'm not trying to pat myself on the back, please. You know, it's not that. It's just trying to explain what I'm trying to do in this field and how I can do it and how I can help make changes. And one of the things is that you have to call things the way they are, man. You just have to, you can't play the game, you know?
Right. Now, with, we talked about, you know, the materialization of sound and EVP and whatnot. What about sight, like shadow figures or full body apparitions? What kind of, how does the model apply to something physically that you see with your eye?
Well, let's take a look at sight. You know, again, let's take a look at it, break it down from a scientific perspective. And one of the things I say to kind of, you know, get people's attention so they kind of put away their existing way of looking at things, excuse me, and get a fresh start, so to speak, is to say that no human being in the history of our race ever saw a thing. We are completely and totally blind.
Mm-hmm.
Can't see anything. The only thing that our eyes are designed to detect is emitting or reflecting photons. We cannot, you cannot see the computer that's in front of you. All you can see is the light that's reflecting off of it or being emitted by the screen. So, once we understand that light and that kind of thought-arresting idea that gets your, you know, taking for granted day-to-day attitude that you can see everything. I don't mean attitude, I mean just way of looking at it. And look at it from a scientific perspective. Then we could see, the first thing we could say is that an apparition or even a shadow figure presents a surface that emits or reflects light. Now, if it's a materialization and it becomes physical, so it can be observed, it can also absorb light. So if we take a look at a very smoky, dark object, you know, let's say like really bad billowing smoke from a chemical fire that's almost black. The reason why it appears that way to us is that very few photons are coming to us from it. That the object, the substance, is absorbing almost the full spectrum of light. The shadow figure does the same thing.
Yeah.
It presents a surface that absorbs almost the full spectrum of light. Just like any kind of a black painted object would do the same thing. So the first thing we could say, it is a materialization. Because if it wasn't material, it wouldn't be able to reflect or absorb light waves. And since it's able to reflect or absorb light waves, then we know it's presenting a physical surface that is consistent to what we know about optics already and what we know about light. See, the effect is normal. It's the cause.
Mm-hmm.
It's paranormal. Because there's no body. A shadow ghost has no body. This is why I say Bigfoot is not paranormal. Because I believe someday somebody going to drag in a body. You know, but nobody is ever going to drag a body in from a shadow ghost. There is no body. There's no hair samples, doesn't leave any footprints. You know, it has no body. It's an effect with no physical local cause.
Right.
Now, given, say sometime in the near future, we unlock, like, everything scientifical about say gravity and time and space and stuff like that. We just have like a profound understanding of everything. Do you think there will be in the future a way to say contain such paranormal activity? Like if you were to say, you know what, I'm gonna bring home this, you know, shadow figure home in this container. I mean, would that even be possible, or is just thinking too far out?
Well, I don't know whether you're thinking too far out, but you know, again, what we've done is, what I've done is I've made a distinction between that, you know, the forensics and the criminology. You know, from studying the physics of the crime scene, so to speak, if I'm able to build or reproduce a firing arm, you know, a gun, so to speak, or maybe we talk about with the driver in the automobile, you know, that's one thing. It's another thing to want to invite Ted Bundy home to dinner.
Right, right.
No, I don't think I want to take a shadow ghost home in a box.
Right.
But that's just me personally. I mean, some people would
get
off that, man. You know, I live in a haunted house. I got blood dripping from the walls. Isn't that cool? No. No, you need to call a bishop and get a 55-gallon drum of bleach and clean your house.
Yeah. Yeah, and
I met a real estate agent once. We walked into the house looking at homes, and it was really creepy. And everybody felt it was creepy, and that's where the line came from. Just came off the top of my head, and you know, the real estate agent is, oh, this just needs some work. I said, yeah, a 55-gallon drum of bleach and a bishop. That's where that line came from. You know, not even a priest. This place needed a bishop. But anyway, I'm digressing, I think.
Oh. Now, you know, my conception of perception, I should say, my perception of paranormal phenomena, and that doesn't just limit it to spirits. You know, even possibly UFOs, but they have to, you know, they exist in another plane, another dimension per se, and somehow or another they have to bend time and space in order to do something in our reality for us to observe or hear or whatnot.
Mm-hmm. You're starting.
Is that right?
Your voice is starting to get real choppy, you know, the transmission. Sort of kind of close to what you're saying.
Yeah, is that right? Are they, for these things to happen, you know, per se, a UFO appearing for a brief second, if it actually is legitimately something that we didn't create as man and test flying, you know, top secret, but in order for something to come on our plane of reality, they have to be in light and in space, time, in order to do something over here in our realm.
Yeah, you know, again, what I'm going to do is apply the same principle, and it helps us in terms of clarity, is that I don't really care whether it's a black ops thing, you know, Area 51, the gray aliens, the Nephilim, the Illuminati, you know, the reptilian that's hiding under your bed. I don't really care about any of that. That's the criminology.
Mm-hmm.
What I want to see, I want to think about the actual observable phenomenon itself. And when we just look at that and forget about who's done it and why they might be doing it, we clearly have to admit that what we're seeing is a physical materialization of information, because it is observable. It is measurable. It has to be physical. And remember, from a scientific viewpoint, matter and energy, as well as the fabric of space and time itself, all fall under the category of, quote, physical, unquote. Some people think that physical is just matter, hard matter, but energy isn't. It's all physical. Everything that is in time, space, matter, and energy is all physical. And so it has to be a physical manifestation. And if it pops in and out of existence, we're looking at the materialization and the dematerialization of information in real time. So, yes, we can form that connection. what I tell people, if you think about it, this is one of the things that I came to a conclusion in my research, is that when you remove the criminology, take, you know, in the paranormal haunted house, you know, take all the ghosts and the goblins and the demons and disembodied Nephilim or who it is, and please go sit in the waiting room over there. And, you know, the aliens and the guys with the big eyes and the green heads and, you know, the government and whoever it is, please go in there and wait in the same room. Go out of the way. I don't want to hear you or see you. All right, they're gone. Now just let's look at the actual physical observations themselves. And we find out that in ufology, the phenomena that's observed is virtually identical to that in paranormal.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that, you know, we've got the perpetrator wound up so much and tied in so much with what we're seeing that we can't sort it out. Give you a good example, all right? One of the very common, what I call a misconception in paranormal phenomena, is when people get malfunctioning of an electronic equipment. And the common
mm-hmm.
thought is, oh, you know, Casper is drawing the energy from the batteries in order to physically manifest. You've heard it.
Yes.
Very common. Well, the problem is with that is that the physics for it just simply isn't there. What, you know, they say, well, Einstein said equals MC squared. Matter and energy can be converted from one form to another. Okay, yeah, but read the formula again. E equals matter times the speed of light squared.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my. So what they're not thinking about is the huge amount of energy that it takes to produce matter, to reverse the effect. So you wouldn't talking about, you know, a ghost draining, you know, a 9-volt battery in order to physically manifest. You'd be talking about draining all the energy out of maybe 20 or 30 square miles, you know, freezing it to absolute zero in order to maybe create like a cigarette smoky mist for maybe a fraction of a second. The entire energy output of our sun is not sufficient to convert to 1 ounce of matter.
Oh, wow.
But, yeah, that's a, you can look that up. That's a scientific fact. It takes an incredible amount of energy. We may use, you know, a couple pounds of fissionable material in a nuclear bomb. But we need that amount of material in order to compress it in such a way to begin the reaction. Once the reaction occurs, there is such a tiny amount of matter that actually gets converted to energy to cause the explosion.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the vast majority of the mass of fissionable material is destroyed in the explosion. So the physics just isn't there. But now let's go to the ufology side for a moment. We see the same paranormal observation. It's been reported thousands of times that in close proximity to a UFO, suddenly people's batteries appear to go dead. You know, the
mm-hmm.
car stops. It won't start. The radio doesn't work. Flashlights don't work anymore. The exact same phenomena that we see in a haunted house during an investigation. But you won't find a single ufologist saying that the UFO is draining your Everettis in order to physically manifest.
Right.
Why?
Because
they're not thinking about it from a ghost-centric viewpoint.
Mm-hmm.
And see, this is one of, and this is why I don't win a lot of popularity contests, guys.
Yeah.
No, I gave a lecture recently online, and one of the members, you know, was asking me a question when I explained to this. You know, one of the other attendees told me later, said, well, that guy went back into the back of the room and talked to his girlfriend and says, well, he's wrong. You know, the physics of ghosts are different than our physics. And my first question would have been to the guy if I had heard it, well, what's physics? What is the meaning of that? And I bet he wouldn't even know what the definition of it was. So it's unfortunate. We have a state in the paranormal field now where it's almost like the music field where, you know, a few guys learn some music in high school and they get it together and have a garage band.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what paranormal teams are, most of them now. They're garage bands.
Yeah.
So anyway, I guess I digressed, but...
No, you're fine.
All right, we talked about the UFO thing, and yeah, it's very much related. Now, here's one of the interesting things. I just want to take a minute to talk about this. Every object in the universe is surrounded by a bending of space. We talked about that a little earlier.
Mm-hmm.
We've also been able to prove, based on Einstein's theories, that gravity is always associated with the bending of space. That the bending of space is always connected with the presence of a gravitational field.
Mm-hmm.
So this is one of the wonderful, amazing, just, you know, exciting aspects of this theory that I have. Is that if we are looking at paranormal phenomena as the materialization of information from a non-local source, it's not coming out of the walls, it's not recorded on the fabric. I love that one. Oh, it's recorded on the fabric of time. How? They don't even know what time means, you know,
right.
When people to say these things, you know. You know, if it is a materialization, any materialization is surrounded by bed space. So the first thing that we have to do to create an environment for information to spontaneously materialize into our local space, as it does in paranormal phenomena, is to have this warp, this bubble of warp space-time that appears. And that warping is going to generate its own gravitational field. So one of the predictions that my theory makes, and this is what's so exciting, is that we should be able, if we can detect the emergence point of a paranormal event, that we will be able to detect a gravitational fluctuation also at that location that won't simply be a distortion in the Earth's gravity, which is kind of like a straight line going to the center of it, of the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
But it will be an emerging field in multiple directions. It'll be what we call on three axes, not just a single axis. And this was an experiment that was conducted by David Rowntree and found it to be true. We would also time distortion. Because remember, if you bend space, you bend time, because space and time are intrinsically intertwined. And so David Rowntree designed an experiment that he passed particles between two transceivers that would translate it into a pitch, in an acoustic pitch. And at the emergence of an electromagnetic field and getting an EVP, finding the emergence point with his quadrilator, which graphs out a room so you can tell where anything is happening in that room, the exact location of it. And the device would change pitches because time was being bent as well. You know, this is incredible. This is like nothing that has ever come down the road before.
Yeah, and, you know, I know, you know, some clients that we've dealt with or whatnot, some of the claims is when paranormal phenomena are happening in their home, they have a lapse in time. They lose, you know, time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I've always wondered about that.
It's difficult to quantify, though, because we're in just the infancy of this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to me, you know, we talk about the, you know, our society, and we talk about our society as it changed from pre-9/11 to post-9/11. You know,
mm-hmm.
I look from my perspective in the paranormal field, you know, of the pre-interview with David Rowntree and the post-interview with David Rowntree, that we entered a new era, and we're just we're in the infancy of this. But yeah, we should be able to see time it distort, dilate on varying scales. Now, one mm-hmm. of the things that leads me to believe that it can happen on a, you know, like a room-wide scale, not just real localized, is that when this is very common, this report that just before a paranormal event, people report getting a feeling of heaviness.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's ever really understood that before or been able to place it in context with any of the other observations. But according to this model, if space is being bent, we have the creation of an additional gravitational field, which means that when people are reporting a feeling of heaviness or like walking through soup or something, what they're reporting is literally true, that they really are getting heavier because they have an additional gravitational field affecting their body and the surrounding area.
Yeah.
Wow. That definitely makes sense.
It's
just like, I was just going to say, just like people that report all the time, you know, that they're sick to their stomach or they're lightheaded right before an event happens.
Oh, yeah. Can you imagine if you were twisting the space that your guts occupied?
Yeah.
See, we don't even know. We never even thought about looking for that kind of an effect.
And right.
We had a theoretical model that, you know, it's just like what I talk about with plate tectonics. Nobody understood what caused earthquakes or volcanoes. And then when we came up with the paradigm of plate tectonics, all the observations and the data fell together. And then we started looking for the places where the plates collide with one another. See, we didn't even know, we didn't have a model to even know how to look for these things.
Mm-hmm.
And now we do. But again, we struggle with what we talked about earlier, that the vast majority of the paranormal community isn't interested in this. Not really. Not really.
Right.
Small portion of it, here's another faction I have to talk about from time to time. There is a portion of the paranormal community that is actively opposed and hostile to this.
Mm-hmm.
Because what they do is they make a living on sustaining the mystery of the paranormal.
Yeah,
as long as it's mysterious and it's the woo-woo, this is how they make their living. Someone who is going to make it understandable to the average person so that it really isn't paranormal anymore, but it's a part of normal, natural reality. These guys are out of business.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And almost overnight, too.
Oh, yeah, it's one of the parallels I give is that there are, I'd bet any amount of money on it, there's a certain percentage of Bigfoot investigators that when they go to bed at night, they kneel down beside their bed and they say a prayer to whatever god they believe in that no one ever, ever, ever drags a body in.
Right.
Because as soon as that person drags a body in, whoever possesses that body becomes the world's leading expert. There's no more mystery. And that person's name that went to all the conventions and all the speaking events and sold all the books and was on TV, he just disappears. He fades into oblivion. Mm-hmm. You know? So they're diametrically opposed to any scientific exposure, although they would feign it. You know, we want to know the truth. No, you don't. No, you don't.
Because, I mean, knowing the truth would negate their existence in the first place, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it would be like, you know, like they say, it's like sawing off the branch that you're sitting on.
Right.
No, you know?
I can understand that.
And you know, guys, you know, again, I'm in a position to say these things. A lot of people in the paranormal community are not.
Right.
So I can start talking about things in ways that, you know, were not able to be talked about before. Come on, let's be honest. You know, if a family has real bad problems within itself, you know, one of the things that they will have to do before they can get it straightened out is to sit down at the table and start having real honest conversations. And this is what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to have honest conversations about this field.
Oh, well, yeah.
And
go ahead.
No, go ahead, Martin.
I was going to say, and I think you're in a better position to talk about these kind of things because you're an outsider looking in. You know, you can make honest and upfront, you know, observations without being hindered by one side or the other.
Yeah, and I'm not trying to win a popularity contest. I'm not trying to compete for all kinds of fantastic evidence so a TV producer is going to call me, because a lot of these people think that they're going to be on TV someday, or they'll hope to be on TV. You know, I don't have to worry about pissing off Zach Bagan, you know, because Zach would never have a guy like me on his show anyway because of what I represent.
Right.
So, you know, it's just like there's a lot of UFO guys that don't want me on their show because a lot of what goes on in the UFO community is a bunch of bunk, too. And somebody that can actually say, you know what, this isn't true, and this is why, and this can't be, and this is why, and this is the science behind it, they don't want a guy like that on the show. They want the guy to say, oh, yeah, man, I got possessed by the blue alien last night. That's what they want to hear.
Right, right. Because it adds that touch of mystery and that touch of, unknown, and you're like, you know, it's the fear factor that keeps this field going, I think.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the thriller shows, the murder mysteries, the Texas Chainsaw stuff, and, you know, the guy that runs around with the ski mask and kills everybody, Jason or something.
Yeah.
They have
huge audiences.
It's a huge revenue stream from this segment of the general public that wants that. They want to be scared. They want to be filled, you know, from a distance, from a safe point, you know. So when they, you know, see what's-his-name, Darren or whatever the guy's name over Most Haunted in England get possessed, or they see Zach get possessed or Chip Coffey get possessed, that's exciting. It's scary. But it's on their TV set, so, you know, they're not directly involved. Big revenue.
Right.
Now, one thing that I'm always curious about, and I know that David is the same way because his fiancée, Tracy Ray, she's a medium. And I've always wondered about that side of the coin when it comes to the paranormal with true people, you know, because there are some out there that claim to be psychic or medium and they're really not.
but people with true gifts that are able to pick up things that, you know, everyday Joe Blow can't. You know, they can see, you know, full body apparitions, you know, a person standing in front of them that looks as real as what we see, but in reality it's not. And I've always wondered about that and, you know, the scientific side of that.
Well, one of the things I can speak to with that is from a theoretical viewpoint. And David Rowntree is actually trying to do something practical with it. And he has been, has experienced a certain amount of success. We could talk about that in a second. But from a theoretical point of view, let's take a look from my perspective of that definition of the universe as a materialization of information, and that the information itself is not material.
Right.
It exists in a place outside of the material and enters into our physical space-time and materializes within it. And we already talked about how that connects so many things together. Let's talk about the human brain for a second. And I really like to talk about the brain rather than the mind or the consciousness, because those things are so subjective and sometimes very vaporous. But the brain is something very hardcore. It's solid, you know. It's a physical structure. Now, we know in physics, or actually in biology and science when we study the brain, that thoughts manifest themselves in the brain as electrochemical components. You know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah.
The electrochemistry is measurable. We can measure it. Just like an EMF reader in a haunted house, we can measure it.
Mm-hmm.
Although they're much more sophisticated because they're actually measuring the quality of the electrochemical constituents, not just the quantity. That's one of the things that paranormal investigators need to do. They need to get devices in there that shows them exactly what frequency they're reading, not just that they have EMF, because it doesn't tell them anything, really. But it's a trophy. You know, hey, I caught a fish. Look, EMF.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry. I digress again.
Okay.
Oh, boy. Somebody smacked that guy. Anyway, all right, so let's take something about psychic for a second. Let's talk about remote viewing, because a lot of people heard about this, and they know the government was involved in it. So it has a bit more credibility and tangibility than some of the other, you know, with psychic phenomena, oftentimes the general public, if they haven't experienced something like it themselves, it's difficult for them to wrap their heads around, so to speak. No pun intended, but, you know, let's say, you know, somebody remote views something. Well, here comes this information about this remote site. And what it does is it materializes in the human brain. And the electrochemical pattern that the human brain generates to correspond with that thought is actually its physical body. It's a materialization of that thought within the arena of the human brain. So it's almost the same thing like an apparition, that when it begins to materialize, we can see it's the radiation in the light spectrum reflecting or emitting off of it. In the brain, when that information materializes, we see the electrochemical constituents of it. So with this paradigm of looking at the universe this way, now we have a way to understand psychic phenomena that is not only reasonable, but it is consistent with normal and paranormal phenomena that we observe in other arenas rather than just a human brain.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
This is where my model allows these things to occur as part of the way the universe is naturally put together. But there's another aspect of it, that this model also predicts. because you remember I was talking about when we have an expansion of space-time in the presence of physical content, let's say the air, it generates electromagnetic field. When information begins to materialize in that bubble, it vibrates the surface of the bubble and propagates an electromagnetic compression wave that is identical to the kind of information that's being materialized. So if something was materializing with a red color, that red wavelength would be represented and carried on that electromagnetic compression wave.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Let's now take a look at some physiology here. Let's take a look at sight and look at it scientifically from a biological viewpoint. We have these receptors. We have these eyeballs that have these rods and cones that are, they do very much like a microphone does. They take the radiation that it detects and the frequency and the wavelength of that radiation and converts it to an electromagnetic compression wave of a very specific kind. And then that electromagnetic compression wave is carried up the optic nerve. And then it goes into the brain, and the brain interprets it as information that it can understand. You follow me so far?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
All right. Now, let me ask you a question. Do you think that the optic nerve can distinguish whether that compression wave is coming from the eyeball or from another source?
No.
No. So some people might be able to see apparitions where other people can't.
Right.
Because we have an electromagnetic compression wave carrying information directly to the optic nerve. This is what I also believe is responsible for certain reports of clairaudience, you know, hearing things that other people don't hear, people carrying a conversation on with a disembodied intelligence that other people can't hear, or one of the most mysterious things in paranormal phenomena is clairolfactance, which is the smelling of odors that have no physical source. You know, like people say, well, in this house, occasionally you smell perfume or you smell this guy's cigar smoke. I believe in some of those instances that we're getting an emergence of an informational body, you know, a cohesive packet of information that involves an odor.
Mm.
Because odors are just information also.
Mm-hmm.
And then that is being projected, propagated directly to the sense of smell, to the nerves that go to the brain. I forget what they're called, the olfactory nerves.
Yeah, yeah.
And then that transfers it to the brain, and the brain smells a smell when there really isn't any odor physically there. So this model also explains that kind of thing, too. We know there's been a lot of experiments that's been done that they've taken subjects and have bombarded their brain with certain kinds of electromagnetic fields, and people have hallucinated. They see colors. They see figures. They hear sounds and smell things that aren't there because it's being directly induced onto the nervous system.
Right. And I think one of the experiments that were done with that is with something called the God Helmet, right? Where they were
Yeah, I've heard of that. David Roundtree talks about that. He's very well versed in it. Here's the kind of interesting thing between which is what the marriage has been so wonderful with. David is the engineer. He is the scientist. He's familiar mm-hmm. with all this technology and these practical, hands-on physical applications. I'm a theorist. It's like Einstein's theory of curved space was proved by a team that had telescopes and cameras that they knew how to work and take the pictures of the certain areas of the sky. Einstein may have never took a photograph in his life. So, yeah, David talks a lot about that God helmet thing.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I've been real interested in it because it could help, you know, explain some of the things that you're dealing with. Because let's say that, you know, a sight, smell, sound, or whatever it is electromagnetic in nature, and it just hits you in your brainwave. You know, that smell could really not even be there. You just, your brain picked it up as an electromagnetic signal, you know?
Yes, but it really is there. It just
mm-hmm.
doesn't exist as a molecular odor.
Right.
You know? So, yeah, and I wanted to specify that because that's very important. The effect is physical. After all, the human brain, and this is one of the things that we get caught up in, you know, that people say certain things that the human brain experiences are imaginary. All right. What exactly does that mean? In common language and in common culture, we consider it imaginary to equal not real. Well, I'm sorry. The human brain is a physical object. And its thoughts are the result of electrochemical patterns.
Mm-hmm.
So that imagination is real. It's something real. Maybe somebody else can't see it. But people don't just simply, and I phrase it this way, they don't just imagine things. They image things.
Right.
Yeah.
So the human brain has an imaging capacity. It's not just the imagination. It's the imaging faculty of the brain. And that's very real.
That could also help explain why, you know, you have a dream that is so real that you wake up and you're like, I can't even believe that that was a dream, you know?
Yeah, I believe... One day, when we understand the science behind the paranormal
mm-hmm.
and things like it, and are able to build technology based upon it, this is one of the things in my book, it's in the chapter Fantastic Possibilities, that we will actually be able to materialize directly into physical reality whatever we can image in our brains. Anybody ever see the old classic Forbidden Planet?
Yeah,
no, I hadn't seen it.
All right. Any of you guys see it?
Yeah, I've seen it. It's been a long time ago.
You remember the helmet that the guy put on and he was able
yeah.
to visualize his thoughts?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what my theory says is possible.
Mm-hmm. That'd
now,
be awesome.
It would be, but then at the same time, it'd be a very, very scary future because you have, you know, you have the yin and the yang. You have people that would use it for the goodness of mankind, and then you have people that would use it to pretty much tear the universe apart.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, that was the theme of Forbidden Planet, that living creatures, intelligent beings, were not able to control it. That it wound up destroying them. But, you know, now we're talking about a moral issue and an ethical issue. You know, my job, so to speak, is to try to show how this is scientifically possible. What humanity does with it is always a question that humanity has to address when it's dealing with technology that allows it to do incredible things.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Now, do you think mankind in general, we're kind of self-limiting our ability to advance because of, you know, because of the whole good and evil thing? Like, say, you know of a way to progress in, say, in science and nature, and just like people are trying to denounce what you're doing just to keep things the way they are.
Well, you know, that's a very you know, there are certain factions in certain fields, in certain genres, that don't like the kind of work that I do, and that other people like me do. They just don't care for it. You know, there's some people that are highly supportive of it, and then you have this big, you know, volume in the middle that are intrigued and they're curious, but they're also tolerant. They're not invested in it one way or the other, but they're not opposed to it either.
Right. Now,
definitely.
Say, from looking from the outside in, what is your version of the future of, say, paranormal and paranormal science? Where do you see
it
going?
Well, what I think is this. What is fueling the current paranormal fad are the television shows. That's not only getting, you know, everybody and their cousin to form a garage band, but it also is making itself prominent in the public mind, in the public consciousness. And these shows establish in the public consciousness what the quote-unquote standard for paranormal investigation is.
Yeah.
Why people go into, investigators go into people's homes and they try to mimic what's seen on TV, because the public interprets that as being legitimate. If they try to do something radically different, they think that investigator's weird.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
I always argue that the public will eventually be the one that establishes what the standard is for what paranormal research really is. And I've had people argue with me for that, and you know, with that, and I said, no, the public will. But what's going to happen is this. I mean, you know, after a number of years, you know, the general public is going to grow tired of seeing Zach Bagan get possessed for one more time. You know, and the TV shows are going to fade.
Yeah.
And all the garage bands are going to ultimately disappear, or a lot of them will. We're already seeing things where, because of the interest, you know, a team goes in and investigates a site and gets activity, and then the very next day it costs you $1,500 to investigate there. So we're already seeing the kind of things where the fad is beginning to go away. There's a lot of paranormal investigators. I see it in the forums. I don't watch this show anymore. I don't watch this show anymore. They're even losing patronage among their own community.
Right.
So when those things fade away, it's going to leave a big vacuum. And that's when science will have the opportunity. You know, along with a theory.
I was just going to agree with you, and I think that small percentage that we were talking about earlier, that very small strand of teams that are out there that are truly trying to look at it from a true scientific point of view and try to come up with experiments and test these things out, those are going to be the ones that are left. Because even when all the fad leaves, they're still on pace to do, you know, because they're actually delving into the science of it. So
yeah. Now, let me give you just a little taste of something. All right? Here we have good scientific findings ready to be publicized. We have a theory that explains them. And let's take a phenomenon like in poltergeist activity of levitation, where things actually move of themselves with no measurable energy source. And we're going to present to the public the possibility that scientifically analyzing and breaking down paranormal phenomena will help us understand how to achieve anti-gravity. Zach who? Jason who? Who was that? I don't remember a guy like that.
What?
See what I'm... That's the future of this field. This is what I envision.
Oh, definitely. Well, we're down to the last 5 minutes of the show, so any websites or places to get your book and or you know do some more reading on your findings?
Yeah, I'm glad it's winding down because I've had just about as much of myself as I can stand. Yeah, you know, the information about my book and related articles where I'll be appearing next, there's even a contact email there, and you can leave comments, you know, to posts. All that can be found at www.cosmicveil.com, cosmicveil.com, and the name of the book is Behind the Cosmic Veil, not Beyond the Cosmic Veil, Behind the Cosmic Veil. It could be gotten on Barnes & Noble or Amazon, but the best price is through our distributor's link on the website.
Awesome. It was great talking to you again. It's always a pleasure. And I'm hoping Jeff and Martin soak some of that in.
It was amazing. It was a great night.
Well, I had a lot of fun with it, and I always appreciate it when, you know, I'm given the opportunity to come on someone's show and share these ideas with everybody and their audiences, you know?
Oh, yeah, definitely. All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on. It was a pleasure, and we'll do it again sometime further down the road when you and David have worked on some more things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and everybody's recovered from the fetal position.
Nice.
Hey, this is just so very different, and you know, so it again, I appreciate the opportunity very much to come on the show and you know, talk with you guys about it.
All right.
Very cool.
You have a great night.
You guys do the same, man.
All right.
Ooh. All right.
It's so nice to have somebody on the show that you can tell they just know what they're talking about, you know?
Well, Jeff thinks he knows what he's talking about, but we know better.
Now, Jeff knows he knows what he's talking about.
Nice.
But it's cool to get a perspective of what's going on in our realm scientifically that makes a lot of sense. Because in reality, the way science is set up, all the spirit world out there, they have to do something scientifically. They have to do something in order for us to pick it up.
Mm-hmm.
They have to manipulate our reality in order for it to happen.
Right.
And, you know, I hopefully agree with what he's talking about. I mean, you have to, in order to fully understand what's going on, you have to have an outsider looking in, because people that are within this field are going to be biased one way or another. I mean, it's like, You can't say, oh, well, you're scientific, when you have no idea what scientific is about, you know. So I'm glad that there's somebody, you know, looking into this field, not being a part of it.
Exactly, which is good, because we talked about earlier, he's not tainted. He's not in the field. He's looking from the outside in. And so to listen about the model and everything, it just spurs more things that I want to try to do, and you know, find out more information, you know, experiments and whatnot, and it just puts that, it relights that fire under my belt to pursue more into the paranormal.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Somebody's dog's barking. It wasn't mine.
Oh, it's mine. My dog is chasing my cat around the living room.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. But, yeah, man, that was a great show tonight. Let's see here. Next week, who do we have on the show? We have Douglas Carahan will be on the show next Sunday, a paranormal investigator. So we're going to talk to him. And once again, I want to say thanks to Thomas Fusco for coming on the show tonight. And hopefully folks in the archives, you had a great experience listening to this, and you'll check out his information and buy his book.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And a plug for my other show that I'll be on Tuesday. We have psychic medium Don Short on the show Tuesday on Terrify Radio.
Cool.
All right, guys. Well, had a great time. Happy St. Patty's Day. All you that are listening in the archives, probably recovering from your hangover from drinking green beer. And we'll talk to everybody again next week.
All righty.
Have a great evening, everybody. Good night.
All right.
Bye.